It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
World records fell, American records fell. Legends grew bigger or were born in Eugene at the new Hayward Field. The World Athletics Championships are over after 10 days. So how exactly did Eugene fare? And what was the reception locally and from TV sets and computer screens around the world? I'm Andrew Thien, and this is Beat Check with your Oregonian. Up next, a quick recap of the World Athletics Championships. I chatted with sports editor Joel Odom. We talked about Sydney McLaughlin and Noah Lyles and Athing Mo and the big takeaways from the meet, what it looked like from inside and outside the stadium, and much more. Here's our conversation. Joel Odom, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Joel, the World Athletics Championships are in the rear view mirror and, you know, people are leaving Eugene for destinations unknown around the globe, most likely around the States. But I'm wondering, kind of as we look back, what performances and specific events stand out as the signature moments?
Well, I think there were several really superlative performances. You know, I think the fact that we, in the second weekend, just the past few days, we saw three world records fall, starting with Friday night. Sydney McLaughlin, the 400-meter hurdler, she dropped her own world record by something like 0.7 seconds. She ran that 400 hurdles race in 50.68 seconds. She had just set, also breaking her own world record, about 3 weeks prior at the U.S. Championships for 51.41. So just how much she shattered her own record was, you know, significant. And that was an amazing performance for sure. And then on Sunday, there were two more. There was the women's 100-meter hurdler, Toby Asuman from Nigeria. And she not only set a world record, but she did it in a semifinal race. You know, she ran, I think her time was 12.12 seconds, dropping the world record. It had been 12.20. And then in the men's pole vault, which sort of put an exclamation point on the meet, the Swedish pole vaulter Armand Duplantis broke his own world record as well. I believe it's the fifth world record that he has set in that event, and he cleared the pole vault bar at 20 feet 4.5 inches. So I would definitely start with the world records that we saw. And then beyond that, you know, there were some really amazing moments elsewhere. You know, the U.S. sprinter Noah Lyles breaking Michael Johnson's American record and winning the 200 meters, dropping that mark to 19.31 from 19.32. And just his celebration, he was very, very excited and, you know, ripped his jersey off and just, you know, went and, you know, hugged his family after. And then there was, you know, a couple of locals, I think, that were very noteworthy with their performances. Ryan Krauser, the men's shot putter, you know, he won his first world championships gold medal. He had already owned the world record and he already had won Olympic gold, but he didn't have the world championships gold. And so, you know, seeing that the first weekend, it was not a surprise, but it was just, you know, a cool moment for him to finally have added that accolade to his long list of accomplishments. And then the other one I would point to, I would say, you know, this might have been just one of the more surprising and also very cool moments was the women's javelin thrower, Kara Winger, who's from Vancouver. You know, she's retiring at the end of this season. She's 36 and is a four-time Olympian. but had never won a global medal. And she sort of had to sneak into the world championships. At the U.S. championships, she not only won the competition on her final throw, but she also achieved the world championship standard distance on that final throw to sort of squeak into making the world championships. And then, you know, in the competition, she had a similar, it was a similar story. She came down to her last throw and, you know, moved up into silver medal position on that final throw. And, you know, again, it was her home, you know, basically her home track. She has competed at Hayward for years and years. And again, just a special moment for her in her final season.
Yeah. Talk about drama too, the stakes, and to do it on the last throw like that is sends shivers up the spine, right? That's what sports is all about.
Exactly.
So you were down there, not inside the confines of Hayward proper, but down in Eugene. Can you talk about what our presence was from the Oregonian down there, kind of who was on the ground and what their impressions were? Because obviously you're working with our reporters who are covering, you know, what's this sprawling event where there's things happening all the time.
Yeah, you know, we had several folks down there who were there throughout the entire, you know, the entire 10 days of competition. And then we also had some rotating reporters who would, you know, come down for a day or two to, you know, pick off different story angles here and there. And, you know, I think it was interesting. The folks who were at the stadium, you know, I mean, it obviously... our sports reporters have covered, you know, meets at Hayward Field plenty of times, but right. this was sort of, I think, on a little bit grander scale than it normally is, you know, even with how many media were covering it from all over the world, and, you know, just sort of how sprawling the, you know, post-race media area was. I mean, it sounds, you know, like the athletes after they came off the track for events, you know, they're put through this, you know, winding maze of different stops that they make to talk to, you know, TV reporters and to, you know, print, you know, reporters and bloggers. And it's just, you know, normally it's a much more straightforward, simple process. But that was interesting to me, just, you know, sort of how many stops they were making, how long that post-race process was for them. But, you know, I think, you know, the impression I got was that, you know, the event was, you know, pretty well organized and well run. And, you know, maybe they would have liked to have had a little bit bigger crowds, but it sounds like the ticket sales were, you know, fairly good and, you know, decent sized crowds.
I'm curious about what we know about attendance at this point. Joel, we're talking Monday morning and, you know, it just ended. But do we know what the figures were?
I know that the final few days attendance figures hovered around, you know, 12,000 for the evening sessions, the final few days, I believe. And the number that I saw from World Athletics was somewhere around 146,000 total tickets sold for the 10 days of competition. You know, Hayward seats, I think the capacity for this event, because they added some temporary seating, I believe it was 15,000 was the new capacity. So yeah, there were definitely empty seats, but you know, I would say it was, you know, maybe 80% full, on the, you know, high interest nights. And I don't think that's particularly bad. I don't think that it's a necessarily a negative sign that they didn't sell out every day of the competition or anything like that. So,
yeah, we, you know, as we're preparing in a newsroom for, you know, any big event, whether it's the World Athletics Championships or the Eclipse back a few years ago, or, you know, responding to a breaking news event, there's a lot of discussion ahead of time, or if it's possible, and planning. And on this one, there's a lot of concern about whether Eugene could handle this. And obviously, for a good reason. This is the first time the U.S. had hosted an event the World Athletics Championships. It's usually in, you know, Beijing or Tokyo or some major global city. And Eugene obviously is super small compared to Beijing. But, you know, what was the story on the ground from reporters that you were managing or just from our planning meetings? Like, did things go according to plan, or did Eugene handle this, or was it overblown? Was it a combination of the two? Kind of what was it like?
You know, the sense I got is that Eugene handled things just fine. I think there were definitely, you know, shops and restaurants right adjacent to the stadium where, you know, there were definitely times after the competition, it would have been difficult to get in at several of the restaurants right around that area. I heard of, you know, hour and a half waits, you know, but I don't think that that's atypical for, you know, any big sporting event. And by and large, I think that the, you know, sort of crush that people had maybe expected or that we thought might happen, it didn't really materialize. And I think part of that, you know, I didn't necessarily think about it ahead of time, but I think part of it is, you know, we're talking about a town that's used to having this entire university population of students, and now it's, you know, in the summer. And so all those students, or a huge percentage of them, are gone. And so, you know, in some ways, I think the track fans just sort of replaced the student population in a way, and the town was able to, you know, for the most part, keep up with it and handle things just fine from an infrastructure type standpoint.
Yeah, I'm a Oregon Duck alum, and anyone who has lived in Eugene knows that it's different if you stay. If you're a student and you stay in the summer, it's a different vibe, and you know, because there aren't the other, you know, 15 to 20,000 additional students, just a handful stay.
For sure.
The sports reporters on your team are an experienced bunch, and they've covered a lot, you know, national championships, NBA playoffs, big events. What was the sense from what you were hearing from them? Like, was this was the old Hayward magic there? Were they kind of saying, you know, that was amazing, or was it you know, didn't have the same feel?
I definitely heard, again, I think for certain moments, certain events, that the crowd was really electric. You know, when the women's Jamaican sprinters swept in the, you know, women's 100 meters, and they also, I think, went 1-2 in the women's 200. You know, one of our reporters, Nick Daschle, was telling me just about how loud the stadium got with, you know, they had the Jamaican fans had noisemakers and were just really, you know, really. It was a big celebration of these
making sprinters. Their presence felt. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Definitely making their presence felt. And, you know, I think it was the same that javelin thrower, Kara Winger, you know, when she was getting ready for her final throw, she asked the crowd for help, started, you know, clapping her hands over her head, and the crowd really responded. And, you know, it was the same at the U.S. Championships for her, where, you know, she really needed that Hayward magic, and the crowd came through for her, and it happened again here. So, you know, and I think with Sydney McLaughlin's run Friday night, I think it was a very loud stadium. So there were definitely moments where I think, you know, longtime track fans who would have been at the old Hayward and then were back at the new one, they would have felt a similar, you know, similar vibe for sure.
All right, let's take a quick break, then we'll come back and talk a bit more with Joel Odom, sports editor for the Oregonian and Oregon Live.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Okay, Joel, so the path to getting the World Championships in Eugene was a long one, but I seem to recall that it kind of started with Vin LaNana, the former coach of the Oregon Ducks track and field program. And I mean, is that right? He was the guy who kind of wanted this to happen, ultimately, if you go back in time. And what was the mission, I guess, to get this mega event in Eugene?
Yeah, I think Vin LaNana definitely is the one who you could point to and say he's the one who originally had this vision to bring this big event. You know, I did hear Phil Knight was interviewed on the telecast, on the NBC telecast, one of the final nights. And, you know, he mentioned that he asked about having the World Championships come to Eugene as long ago as 1995. So, wow. You know, we can't count out Phil Knight's contributions as well, but yeah, it was, you know, 2015, I believe, is when, you know, when the governing body, the world governing body for track and field, decided to site these championships in Eugene. And yeah, Vin LaNana had a key role in that. And I think, you know, whether you're talking about LaNana or Phil Knight, I think the, you know, sort of their idea and mission was the same, which is, you know, Eugene's Tracktown USA. There's obviously, you know, a ton of history and, you know, iconic athletes and iconic performances that have come out of Eugene. And so, you know, let's have it be a showpiece for the world that, you know, we can host a big event in a similar way as, you know, all these other giant cities in the world have done so with the World Championships in the past. You know, Doha, Qatar in 2019, and London in 2017, and Beijing in 2015, Moscow in 2013, you know. So,
and do you think that they accomplished that? I know we're still, people are literally cleaning up as we speak in Eugene, I'm sure, but did they accomplish that to show that Eugene can do this?
I suppose time will tell, you know, exactly how Eugene gets judged for, you know, the way that the event came off. But I think the early reports are that things went well. And, you know, the United States definitely showed well at these championships. They came away with 33 medals, which is a record for world championships for any country. And, you know, they had, I believe it's three different sweeps that they had, you know, sweeping the medals. And so I think the event sort of, you know, it went smoothly enough, and it showed between some big performances and, you know, world records falling. I think it was, if you were watching from anywhere in the world, you saw, hey, you know, this was an exciting meet, regardless of, you know, where it was being held. I think the early signs are that it was a success and went off well.
At the same time, Joel, I think one of the main things that people will take away from this event, especially people who don't pay attention to track and field, happened right towards the very beginning, involving a name that a lot of Oregonians might know, or specifically Oregon Duck fans. Remind us what happened with Devin Allen, and what does this whole situation say about just track and, you know, how it's hard to crack through to the mainstream?
Yeah, what an unfortunate situation that was. Obviously, just devastating for Devin Allen himself. So what happened was, Devin Allen, who's a two-sport star, he played wide receiver for the Oregon Ducks and ran track for them as well. And now, as a professional, is a hurdle specialist at the 110 meter hurdles, and was among the favorites to medal and potentially maybe, you know, vie for the gold medal in the 110 hurdles final last Sunday night, the first Sunday of the meet. And, you know, he lines up for the race, the gun goes off, and there's a, you know, a false start. And, what was interesting about it was it wasn't a false start because he left the blocks too early, before the gun went off. It was a false start because, the measuring system that determines when he left the blocks, the, you know, computerized technology, said that he had left the blocks 0.099 seconds after the gun went off, whereas the allowable time is 0.100 seconds. So by 1/1000th of a second, Devin Allen winds up getting disqualified and is sent off the track, and his lane is open for the final. And it's, you know, a stunning thing for him, and also, you know, for the fans. And there's, you know, I'm sure for, as you said, the casual track fan out there, it's just mass confusion. How does this happen? Why is he disqualified over reaction time? And so, yeah, it points to sort of this issue that track has where, you know, sometimes their rules and procedures are so, you know, technical and, you know, precise that, it sort of gets in the way of following it as a spectator sport. And so there was a lot of talk afterward that, you know, track and field needs to change that rule or look at that rule, because, you know, on the video replays, it doesn't appear that, you know, he didn't react before the gun went off and didn't seem like he, you know, had any advantage. And so, yeah, it was just a really unfortunate situation. And it, you know, in what we expected was going to be a huge moment, you know, him running basically on his home track and with a chance to medal. And it was the same night that, you know, Ryan Krauser, another Oregon guy, won the gold medal in the shot put. So it had the potential to just be, you know, this huge moment in Oregon track and field. And instead it turned into just, you know, such a unfortunate situation.
Yeah, and Devin's other sport, football, and other sports like basketball, you know, aren't immune to technological creep, so to speak, when you think of all the instant replays that we see about whether they, you know, did the ground dislodge the ball, for example.
What is a catch, right?
In the NFL, exactly. It
has been an interesting debate, but yeah, it sort of, you know, it was too bad because it kind of took some of the shine off of that night and off of, again, yeah, a local star who, you know, everyone sort of had figured would be, you know, in the spotlight and, you know, likely a medal contender.
It's bizarre, a little bit bizarre to me that, you know, reading our coverage, the track head honchos are saying, you know, right in the, as this is ending, that, you know, the goal is to make track just like a big success as we look ahead to 2028. So they're saying it themselves, right, Joel, that they want to grow the sport, which I guess, you know, makes sense regardless of the sport, but it seems like it's just like this decades long push. But, you know, I'm thinking back to when I was a kid, and I guess Marion Jones and Michael Johnson, and, you know, they're big stars, and Flojo before that, and Carl Lewis. But I guess is the hope that, you know, the Sydney McLaughlins and the Noah Lyles and you know, a thing Mo, the American 800 meter phenom, who we haven't talked about yet, but also had a huge moment, like that they're going to be just mega stars come 2028, because that seems hard in our crowded sports media landscape that you know so well.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge for them. You know, I don't think you're suddenly going to make track and field, you know, one of the top three or four spectator sports in this country. And it might never happen, you know. Obviously, from their perspective, you know, you have to try, right? I mean, it's the fact that you have so much star power in the sport here you know, sort of drives home Sebastian Coe's point that, you know, it's the United States when you're comparing it to the interest in other countries in track and field, you know, he says the United States is not punching its weight. And that's definitely true, but it's also true that it would be difficult for the U.S. to actually reach that point. It's, you know, the big sports, the NFL and the NBA and, you know, college sports behind them, there are a lot of high interest sports that are going to eclipse track and field at this point. And I'm not sure how that changes and if that changes. I think dynamic young stars will definitely help. Yes, Sydney McLaughlin, Noah Lyles, names like that could definitely help, but it doesn't pervade our culture in the same way that I think that it probably did in the 80s and 90s with the names you mentioned, like Carl Lewis, Michael Johnson, you know, Flojo. So I don't know that I see it having some significant meteoric growth. But I also don't know that it has to have that in order to still be relevant and viable in our sports landscape. I think that you have these high interest stars, they're going to get noticed, you know, even if it's not year round and all the time, they're going to get noticed when the big competitions do come up. And I do think that the 2028 Olympics in Los Angeles will be a big deal. I think that there will be a ton of interest in those games. And yeah, there are stars right now who are still going to be relevant and winning medals 6 years from now.
Yeah. And Sebastian Coe is the person I was referencing who I couldn't think of the name. That's the president of World Athletics, right?
Correct.
I guess 2028 is not that far away. And Thing Mo will only be 26 or something like that. So she'll be in the prime of her career. So and talking about sports landscape, right? I mean, look at baseball where they have arguably more stars than they've had in a long time. And it feels like they're on the outside, you know, in a lot of respects in gaining attention. It's hard when the NFL and the NBA are year round sports making headlines.
Right.
So, what happens from here? I mean, is this a one-off? Is this the first and only World Athletics Championship in Eugene, or is it going to be coming back sometime down the line?
Yeah, you know, what happens from here is likely it would be a long time before Eugene were to host the World Championships again, if ever. You know, I know they like to rotate it around. But, you know, there will continue to be big, important track meets held at Hayward Field. The Prefontaine Classic, which is an annual event, is one of the best, you know, best track meets in the world on a consistent basis. It draws, you know, world-class talent in a similar way to the World Championships. It's just not every single event in track and field, but you know, it's part of the Diamond League circuit, mm-hmm. that is, you know, basically the pro circuit in track and field. And I think next year, Hayward is going to host the Diamond League finals, you know, that's significant. It's sort of like the, you know, championship for that pro circuit. And I think that will be its first time hosting. So, you know, now that this stadium has been modernized and you know, all this money has been poured into a complete and total renovation, it's ready to continue to host world-class track meets. And I think that people like Phil Knight are going to continue to try to make that happen.
Speaking of Phil Knight, obviously, he was a long distance or middle distance, long distance runner at U of O, and that's always been kind of the lifeblood of the diehards, is what they care about. Maybe it doesn't have the cultural resonance in America as the sprinters, or maybe that's just where the talent is. We didn't talk at all about Jakob Ingebrigtsen and He seems like kind of a spunky character who, he's not an American, but, he's, obviously got a lot of personality, the Norwegian who won the 5,000 meter, and that's not even his best event. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, if we're talking about young stars in track and field, I was definitely remiss in not mentioning Jakob Ingebrigtsen. You know, he was the heavy favorite, or at least among the top favorites, to win the 1500 meters. He's the reigning Olympic champion in that event. And he was beaten. He took the silver medal. He definitely, it was only a day or two after that, I think, that the first round of the men's 5,000 took place. And after that, I remember the quote from him after that first round of the 5,000 was, something along the lines of that he didn't see any reason why he wouldn't win in the final. His remarks after he went on and went and won the final on Sunday, continued to demonstrate that he's not lacking for confidence. It was at the, on his final lap of the first round of the 5,000, he's coming down the home straight and he's lifting his arms to pump up the crowd for more cheers. Like, come on, give it to us. In the final yesterday, which was, it was a warm afternoon for sure. But, in the middle of the race, he's at least once or twice he stops at the water table to grab water, which is unusual for a on the track event. Most guys don't do that, and he still finds a way to go to the front and win the thing at the end. So I think if we're talking about stars who can drive interest and continue to make the sport relevant, he's definitely one who could be a factor there, because he has the big presence and the talent to back it up.
Now I'm curious, Joel, as we kind of wrap up here, I covered the trials back in 2008, so like a long time ago, but I remember kind of a sense that this was, it created a little village, right? Where there's a little bubble around the old Hayward at the time, and like people were all kind of, right there on, whether it was on Agate Street or adjacent to the stadium, and maybe they didn't get out and explore Eugene much. And it seems from our coverage that a lot of the rest of this city was geared up for crowds that didn't ultimately materialize. And I'm wondering, and that could be for many reasons, but I'm wondering if, like, going forward, we're going to have this little bubble that is this track mecca, this international destination, but where you can get everything you need right there, but maybe Eugene isn't going to benefit as much, if that makes any sense. Do you think that could be a dynamic where, the rest of the town isn't getting the traffic because everyone's just hanging out right there? Because why leave when, Nike and the sponsors provide everything you need right there?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure how much, how far beyond the bubble people did go. Again, I think, yeah, the businesses that were right there probably, benefited greatly. But yeah, I'm not sure. One of the things that I heard was that, just kind of anecdotally was that, the athletes really appreciated that they weren't having long bus rides to the stadium, like they might have had if they were, at the World Championships in a large city and were staying way off site or something. So I think there's give and take there. I think that it probably makes for, a unique experience for the athletes if the athlete village is right adjacent to the stadium and things like that. But it probably does have, it does have the potential to put a dent in the businesses farther out from that sphere. But I would say that, there were still a significant number of fans who are staying probably all over the city, and who were, patronizing shops and restaurants all around town. And that, you know, I think that Eugene also did a pretty good job of trying to, you know, create other places. You know, they had the Riverfront Festival that was going on throughout, and with, you know, lots of food carts and, you know, kids events, and a huge screen where people could watch, you know, watch the events. And so, you know, there was effort made to make the World Championships live, you know, somewhat outside of the little U of O circle. So yeah, it's hard to say exactly how much there was as far as benefit for the businesses, you know, just anywhere in Eugene, but I would venture to say that it was still a net positive.
Well, all the event coverage and write-ups and great reporting from that event live online at OregonLive.com. And I thank you for taking time to talk about it and for shepherding coverage from a pretty fascinating 10 days.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Beat Check with the Oregonian. You can go back and read our coverage from Eugene at OregonLive.com/Oregon22 or HereIsOregon.com/Oregon22. If you like this show, give us a 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts. It really helps others find the show. And tell a friend. Help spread the word. The best way to support our journalism is through a subscription to Oregon Live. You can do that at OregonLive.com/podsupport. Until next time.